Body aches at bedtime? Sierracil is a natural mineral supplement that supports joint health, calms inflammation, and we're so sure it'll work for you as it has for me and my husband for over 10 years. It has a money-back guarantee. Go to sierracil.com, S-I-E-R-R-A-S-I-L, and use the code DRIFT for 14% off. Hello, I'm Erin, and welcome to Drift. I'm exploring with you tonight, as I have done now twice before, some of the great writer H.G. Wells' work. Not his science fiction, with which his name would become most closely associated. No. This is more history, archaeology, and geography, all wrapped up into a sleepy package for you, from the century-old book, A Short History of the World. Before we get, though, to our third and final part tonight, the first true men, and women, of course, we want to thank our sponsors. You've heard about Envy Pillow. These two incredible women who have added immeasurable comfort to our modern-day beds, airplane seats, even hotel rooms with their Envy Pillow products. Kathy and Kim are two Canadian self-starters who even turned down money from the Dragon's Den folks to bring you pillows, masks, glorious sheets, and so much more, all to make your sleep healthier and more heavenly. Read more in the morning at Envy, that's E-N-V-Y, pillow.com, and use the code DRIFT for 10% off. Before we get into the writing of H.G. Wells tonight, let's do something for ourselves with a few moments of relaxation. Close your eyes. Wherever you are, whether in bed or a chair, perhaps you're traveling and just need that little nudge to take your mind off of everything. Thank you for being here. We'll start with a deep breath in and out. And as we do it again this time, feel the breath entering your lungs through your nostrils or your mouth. Breathe in, feeling that life-giving air. And breathe out. Now, I'll ask you to let your body feel heavy wherever you are. Lower your shoulders. Let your head feel heavy on your pillow or headrest. And now that your shoulders aren't quite doing so much work, allow your arms and hands to just be limp. Take in another deep breath now. Let that life go right down to your feet and out. And if you're able, swivel your ankles a bit and then let them rest. Now, your calves and your thighs, let them feel heavy. Your backside, your back, around to your belly. And finally, with one last deep breath in, your chest full. And now out. Your whole torso and shoulders and neck and legs and arms, hands and feet are all relaxed. And if you would, just think these words. I am safe. I am loved. I am at peace. And if you're ready, let's drift. The first true men. The earliest signs and traces at present known to science of a humanity which is indisputably kindred with ourselves have been found in Western Europe and particularly in France and Spain. Bones, weapons, scratchings upon bone and rock, carved fragments of bone, and paintings in caves and upon rock surfaces, dating from 30,000 years ago or more, have been discovered in both these countries. Spain is at present the richest country in the world in these first relics of our real human ancestors. Of course, our present collections of these things are the merest beginnings of the accumulations we may hope for in the future, when there are searchers enough to make a thorough examination of all possible sources, and when other countries in the world, now inaccessible to archaeologists, have been explored in some detail. The greater part of Africa and Asia has never even been traversed yet by a trained observer interested in these matters and free to explore, and we must be very careful, therefore, not to conclude that the early true men were distinctively inhabitants of Western Europe, or that they first appeared in that region. In Asia or Africa, or submerged beneath the sea, there may be richer and much earlier deposits of real human remains than anything that has yet come to light. These first real human beings we know of in Europe appear already to have belonged to one or other of at least two distinct races. One of these races was of a very high type indeed. It was tall and big-brained. One of the women's skulls found exceeds in capacity that of the average man of today. One of the men's skeletons is over 6 feet in height. The physical type resembled that of the North American indigenous people. From the Cro-Magnon cave in which the first skeletons were found, these people have been called Cro-Magnards. They were savages, but savages of a high order. In the second race, the race of the Grimaldi cave remains. Its nearest living affinities are the Bushmen and Hottentots of South Africa. It is interesting to find at the very outset of the known human history that mankind was already racially divided into at least two main varieties, and one is tempted to unwarrantable guesses as that the former race was probably brownish rather than black, and that it came from the east or north, and that the latter was blackish rather than brown and came from the equatorial south. And these creatures of perhaps 40,000 years ago were so human that they pierced shells to make necklaces, painted themselves, carved images of bone and stone, scratched figures on rocks and bones, and painted rude but often very able sketches of beasts and the like upon the smooth walls of caves. They made a great variety of implements, much smaller in scale and finer than those of the Neanderthal men. We have now in our museums great quantities of their implements, their statuettes, their rock drawings, and the like. The earliest of them were hunters. Their chief pursuit was the wild horse, the little bearded pony of that time. They followed it as it moved after pasture. And they also followed the bison. They knew the mammoth because they have left us strikingly effective pictures of that creature. To judge by one rather ambiguous drawing, they trapped and killed it. They hunted with spears and throwing stones. They do not seem to have had the bow, and it is doubtful if they had yet learned to tame any animals. They had no dogs. There is one carving of a horse's head and one or two drawings that suggest a bridled horse. But the little horses of that age and region could not have carried a man. And if the horse was domesticated, it was used as a led horse. It is doubtful and improbable that they had yet learned the rather unnatural use of animals' milk as food. They may have had tents of skins, and though they made clay figures, they never rose to the making of pottery. Since they had no cooking implements, their cookery must have been rudimentary or non-existent. They knew nothing of cultivation, and nothing of any sort of basket work or woven cloth, Except for their robes of skin or fur, they were naked and painted. These earliest known men hunted the open steppes of Europe for 100 centuries, perhaps, and then slowly drifted and changed before a change of climate. Europe was growing milder and damper. Reindeer receded northward and eastward, and bison and horses followed. The steppes gave way to forests, and red deer took the place of horse and bison. River and lake fishing became of great importance to men, and fine implements of bone increased. The bone needles of this age are superior to those of later, even historical times, down to the Renaissance. The Romans, for example, never had needles comparable to those of this age. Almost 15,000 or 12,000 years ago, a fresh people drifted into the south of Spain and left very remarkable drawings of themselves upon exposed rock faces there. These were the Azilians, named for the Mazdazil cave. They had the bow, they seemed to have worn feather headdresses, they drew vividly, but also they had reduced their drawings to a sort of symbolism that suggests the dawn of the writing idea. By 10,000 or 12,000 years, a new sort of life has dawned in Europe. Men have learnt not only to chip, but to polish and grind stone implements, and they have begun cultivation. The Neolithic Age, or New Stone Age, was beginning. Primitive thought. And now, let us indulge in a very interesting speculation. How did it feel to be a man in those early days of the human adventure? How did men think, and what did they think in those remote days of hunting and wandering 400 centuries ago, before seed time and harvest began? Those were days long before the written record of any human impressions, and we are left almost entirely to inference and guesswork in our answers to these questions. The sources to which scientific men have gone in their attempts to reconstruct that primitive mentality are very various. Recently, the science of psychoanalysis, which analyzes the way in which the egotistic and passionate impulses of the child are restrained, suppressed, modified, or overlaid to adapt them to the needs of social life, seem to have thrown a considerable amount of light upon the history of primitive society. And another fruitful source of suggestion has been the study of the ideas and customs of such contemporary savages as still survive. Again, there is a sort of mental fossilization which we find in folklore and the deep-lying irrational superstitions and prejudices that still survive among modern civilized people. And finally, we have in the increasingly numerous pictures, statues, carvings, symbols, and the like, as we draw near to our own time, clearer and clearer indications of what man found interesting and worthy of record and representation. Primitive man probably thought very much as a child thinks, that is to say, in a series of imaginative pictures. He conjured up images, or images presented themselves to his mind, and he acted in accordance with the emotions they aroused. So a child or an uneducated person does today. Systematic thinking is apparently a comparatively late development in human experience. It has not played any great part in human life until within the last 3,000 years. And even today, those who really control and order their thoughts are but a small minority of mankind. Most of the world still lives by imagination and passion. Probably the earliest human societies, in the opening stages of the true human history, were small family groups, just as the flocks and herds of the earlier mammals arose out of families which remained together and multiplied, so probably did the earliest tribes. But before this could happen, a certain restraint upon the primitive egotisms of the individual had to be established. The fear of the father and respect for the mother had to be extended into adult life, and the natural jealousy of the old man of the group for the younger males as they grew up had to be mitigated. The mother, on the other hand, was the natural advisor and protector of the young. Human social life grew up out of the reaction between the crude instinct of the young to go off and pair by themselves as they grew up, on the one hand, and the dangers and disadvantages of separation, on the other. An anthropological writer of great genius, J.J. Atkinson, in his Primal Law, has shown how much of the customary law of savages, the taboos that are so remarkable a fact in tribal life, can be ascribed to such a mental adjustment of the needs of the primitive human animal to a developing social life. And the later work of the psychoanalysts has done much to confirm his interpretation of these possibilities. Some speculative writers would have us believe that respect and fear of the old man and the emotional reaction of the primitive savage to older protective women, exaggerated in dreams and enriched by fanciful mental play, played a large part in the beginnings of primitive religion and in the conception of gods and goddesses. Associated with this respect for powerful or helpful personalities was a dread and exaltation of such personages after their deaths, due to their reappearance in dreams. It was easy to believe that they were not truly dead, but only fantastically transferred to a remoteness of greater power. The dreams, imaginations, and fears of a child are far more vivid and real than those of a modern adult, and primitive man was always something of a child. He was nearer to the animals also, and he could suppose them to have motives and reactions like his own. He could imagine animal helpers, animal enemies, animal gods. One needs to have been an imaginative child oneself to realize again how important, significant, portentous, or friendly strangely shaped rocks, lumps of wood, exceptional trees, or the like may have appeared to the men of the old Stone Age, and how dream and fancy would create stories and legends about such things that would become credible as they told them. Some of these stories would be good enough to remember and tell again. The women would tell them to the children, and so establish a tradition. To this day, most imaginative children invent long stories in which some favorite doll or animal or some fantastic semi-human being figures as the hero, and primitive man probably did the same, with a much stronger disposition to believe his hero real. For the very earliest of the true men that we know of were probably quite talkative beings. In that way, they have differed from the Neanderthalers and had an advantage over them. The Neanderthaler may have been a speechless animal. Of course, the primitive human speech was probably a very scanty collection of names, and may have been eked out with gestures and signs. There is no sort of savage so low as not to have a kind of science of cause and effect. For primitive man was not very critical in his associations of cause with effect. He very easily connected an effect with something quite wrong as its cause. "You do so-and-so," he said, "and so-and-so happens. You give a child a poisonous berry, and it dies. You eat the heart of a valiant enemy, and you become strong." There we have two bits of cause and effect association, one true, one false. We call the system of cause and effect in the mind of a savage fetish. But fetish is simply savage science. It differs from modern science in that it is totally unsystematic and uncritical, and so more frequently wrong. In many cases, it is not difficult to link cause and effect. In many others, erroneous ideas were soon corrected by experience. But there was a large series of issues of very great importance to primitive man, where he sought persistently for causes and found explanations that were wrong, but not sufficiently wrong, nor so obviously wrong, as to be detected. It was a matter of great importance to him that game should be abundant, or fish plentiful and easily caught. And no doubt he tried and believed in 1,000 charms, incantations, and omens to determine these desirable results. Another great concern of his was illness and death. Occasionally, infections crept through the land and men died of them. Occasionally, men were stricken by illness and died, or were enfeebled without any manifest cause. This, too, must have given the hasty, emotional mind of primitive man much feverish exercise. Dreams and fantastic guesses made him blame this, or appeal for help to that man, or beast, or thing. He had the child's aptitude for fear and panic. Quite early in the little human tribe, older, steadier minds, sharing the fears, sharing the imaginations, but a little more forceful than others, must have asserted themselves to advise, to prescribe, to command. This they declared unpropitious, and that imperative, this an omen of good, and that an omen of evil. The expert in fetish, the medicine man, was the first priest. He exhorted, he interpreted dreams, he warned, he performed the complicated hocus-pocus that brought luck or averted calamity. Primitive religion was not so much what we now call religion as practice and observance, and the early priest dictated what was indeed an arbitrary primitive practical science. Chapter 13, The Beginnings of Cultivation. We are still very ignorant about the beginnings of cultivation and settlement in the world, although a vast amount of research and speculation has been given to these matters in the last 50 years. All we can say with any confidence at present is that sometime around 15,000 and 12,000 BC, while the Azilian people were in the south of Spain, and while the remnants of the earlier hunters were drifting northward and eastward, somewhere in North Africa or Western Asia or in that great Mediterranean valley that is now submerged under the waters of the Mediterranean Sea, there were people who, age by age, were working out two vitally important things. They were beginning cultivation, and they were domesticating animals. They were also beginning to make, in addition to their chipped implements of their hunter forebears, implements of polished stone. They had discovered the possibility of basketwork and roughly woven textiles of plant fiber, and they were beginning to make a rudely modeled pottery. They were entering upon a new phase in human culture, the Neolithic phase, New Stone Age, as distinguished from the Paleolithic, Old Stone phase of the Cro-Magnons, the Grimaldi people, the Azilians, and their like. Slowly, these Neolithic people spread over the warmer parts of the world, and the arts they had mastered, the plants and animals they had learned to use, spread by imitation and acquisition even more widely than they did. By 10,000 BC, most of mankind was at the Neolithic level. Now the plowing of land, the sowing of seed, the reaping of harvest, threshing and grinding may seem the most obviously reasonable steps to a modern mind, just as to a modern mind it is a commonplace that the world is round. What else could you do? People will ask. What else can it be? But to the primitive man of 20,000 years ago, neither of the systems of action and reasoning that seem so sure and manifest to us all today were at all obvious. He felt his way to effectual practice through a multitude of trials and misconceptions, with fantastic and unnecessary elaborations and false interpretations at every turn. Somewhere in the Mediterranean region, wheat grew wild, and man may have learned to pound and then grind up its seeds for food long before he learned to sow. He reaped before he sowed. And it is a very remarkable thing that throughout the world, wherever there is sowing and harvesting, there is still traceable the vestiges of a strong, primitive association of the idea of sowing with the idea of a blood sacrifice, and primarily of the sacrifice of a human being. It was an entanglement, we must remember, in the childish, dreaming, myth-making primitive mind. No reasoned process will explain it. But in that world of 12 to 20,000 years ago, it would seem that whenever seed time came round to the Neolithic peoples, there was a human sacrifice. And it was not the sacrifice of any mean or outcast person. It was the sacrifice usually of a chosen youth or maiden, a youth more often who was treated with profound deference and even worship up to the moment of his immolation. He was a sort of sacrificial god-king, and all the details of his killing had become a ritual directed by the old, knowing men and sanctioned by the accumulated usage of ages. At first, primitive men, with only a very rough idea of the seasons, must have found great difficulty in determining when was the propitious moment for the seed time sacrifice and the sowing. There is some reason for supposing that there was an early stage in human experience when men had no idea of a year. The first chronology was in lunar months. It is supposed that the years of the biblical patriarchs are really moons, and the Babylonian calendar shows distinct traces of an attempt to reckon seed time by taking 13 lunar months to see it round. This lunar influence upon the calendar reaches down to our own days. If usage did not dull our sense of its strangeness, we should think it a very remarkable thing indeed that the Christian Church does not commemorate Easter on the proper anniversaries, but on dates that vary year by year with the phases of the moon. It may be doubted whether the first agriculturalists made any observation of the stars. It is more likely that stars were first observed by migratory herdsmen, who found them a convenient mark of direction. But once their use in determining seasons was realized, their importance to agriculture became very great. The seed time sacrifice was linked up with the southing or northing of some prominent star. A myth and worship of that star was for primitive man an almost inevitable consequence. It is easy to see how important the man of knowledge and experience, the man who knew about the blood sacrifice and the stars, became in this early Neolithic world. The fear of uncleanness and pollution, and the methods of cleansing that were advisable, constituted another source of power for the knowledgeable men and women. For there have always been witches as well as wizards, and priestesses as well as priests. The early priest was really not so much a religious man as a man of applied science. His science was generally empirical and often bad. He kept it secret from the generality of men very jealously. But that does not alter the fact that his primary function was knowledge, and that his primary use was a practical use. 12 or 15,000 years ago, in all of the warm and fairly well-watered parts of the old world, these Neolithic human communities, with their class and tradition of priests and priestesses, and their cultivated fields and their development of villages and little walled cities, were spreading, age by age, adrift. And exchange of ideas went on between these communities. Originating somewhere in the Mediterranean and Western Asiatic area, it spread age by age eastward, and from island to island across the Pacific, until it may have even reached America and mingled with the more primitive ways of living of the Mongoloid immigrants coming down from the north. Wherever the brownish people with the Heliolithic culture went, they took with them all or most of a certain group of curious ideas and practices. Some of them are such queer ideas that they call for the explanation of the mental expert. They made pyramids and great mounds and set up great circles of big stones, perhaps to facilitate the astronomical observation of the priests. They made mummies of some or all of their dead. They tattooed and circumcised. They had the old custom, known as the couvade, of sending the father to bed and rest when a child was born. If we were to make a map of the world with dots to show how far these group practices have left their traces, we should make a belt along the temperate and subtropical coasts of the world, from Stonehenge and Spain, across the world to Mexico and Peru. But Africa, below the equator, North Central Europe, and North Asia would show none of these dottings. There lived races who were developing upon practically independent lines. And as you travel off to sleep now, dear listener, I thank you for sharing in these stories of A Short History of the World by H.G. Wells. And now, as old as time, the waves of the ocean come into shore and recede again from whence they came. And I will wish you a good night and sweet dreams.